Hansen here from NFL Red Zone. I hope you're checking out 1 hour of 5 Yard Rush, one of the best podcasts on NFL football in the UK.
Yo, what's happening, Rush Nation? We're back. The fantasy now, Murph. Before we get into this, fantasy football is all bar done. This is Monday night, so this will go out on Tuesday. So when you hear this, fantasy football will be done for...
Well, there's no football tonight.
Oh, no, there isn't. It was late night Sunday. No Monday night. Fantasy football's done. It doesn't matter how many times I go through this. I always get this wrong. But fantasy football is now 100% done. And what does that mean? Well, it means guests are available to come back on because the Week 16 busyness has happened and we've brought back an absolute banger. Before we get to today's guest, big man, how are you? Happy New Year. Welcome to 2021, which is 2020 with a one on the end.
Yeah, or 2020.1, if you're going to get really nerdy like me.
Okay.
It's kind of like a do-over. It's like a new version of 2020. All good. I can't say it's been any different. you know, this waiting on tenderhooks for lockdowns, it feels a little bit too familiar to what we've been doing. I mean, the one thing is, you know, for the first time in over a decade, Buccaneers are going to be playing past week 17. So that's kind of new. My football team, Arsenal, have won 3 games in a row and... that's kind of new. That's not happened for a long time. So I guess there's some optimism in my sports teams. And fantasy football is not over because we are running four playoff leagues.
No, I'm not having you do this to me. I know that we are doing that. I meant the normal fantasy football season.
Yeah, I finished my season with a win in week 17, which is a nice way to finish the season given week 16. I feel like we left some trophies out on the shelf, and I played 1,075 heads-up games of fantasy football this year. So I'm glad to see the rearview mirror of that a little bit, and I'll tell you what my record is if you give me 2 seconds.
That almost feels like 1,000 too many. If you said 75 games, like 15 in a league, something like that, you're looking at, what, 7 leagues there? That would be fine. But then you played 1,000 on top of that. I mean, what's going on?
I finished with a record of 609 wins and 466 losses.
Take
and 11 titles. So not the worst fantasy football season ever, but definitely won't be playing 1,075 games next year. That's for sure. But anyway, enough about that.
Hey, yeah, we brought on a guest. It's time to bring back host of the Fits on Fantasy podcast, contributor to thefootballgirl.com, and according to Fantasy Pros, just some small, tiny fantasy website over there, he is the most accurate ranker on the planet. It's Pat Fitzmaurice. Pat, welcome back to 5 Yard Rush. Congratulations on being the top ranker in the fantasy community. How are you doing, buddy?
Oh, doing well, Stocks and Murph. Great to talk to both of you guys again. Thank you so much. Greatest ranker for this year only, of course. An ongoing thing. Certainly, there are a lot of very good rankers who I don't know if I'm on that.
You are. You've had a great record over the last 5 years. Let's not go past, you know, let's not overlook the top 5 and top 10 finishes you've had in the last few years.
No, very kind. Very kind. Thank you. But yeah, so good to be on with both of you guys. So good to catch Murph when Arsenal is, you know, no longer in danger of being relegated.
That's right.
Still nowhere near the top of the table where, you know, my Spurs dwell, but that's all right. They're working on it.
Enjoy it while you can. I think that gap's not that big now. It's what, 9 points? Considering it was like 20 like a few weeks ago.
It's closing
at rate of knots. Yeah, no, listen, hats off to Spurs. They're having a good season, and you know, we're just waiting for the Jose Mourinho universe to implode like it always does.
It will happen, I'm sure, at some point.
It will. But yeah, no, it's great to have you back. You're always one of my favorite guests. And I was like, right, this is the guy we're going to kick off 2021. Big year, big range of guests we're going to have on in the next few months. But you were at the top of my list. So I'm glad that we were able to get you to kick off the return of our guests, because it felt very strange in 2023, the season. We didn't have as many guests on with our recording schedules, being at home so much with little ones. And I've got a very loud voice, so that would mean keeping my son up more than one night a week, which isn't ideal and puts me in trouble. to say the least. And then, yeah. And also I know you guys and everyone in the States have obviously had, what's been going on? We last spoke in the summer, I believe. So what's been going on and, you know, becoming the best fantasy ranker on the planet?
Well, it was nice to have the football season as a diversion and just sports, I guess, generally as a diversion. Do you remember back in the early days of the pandemic when there were no sports in March and April? I mean, it seemed like time was just crawling along. And, you know, I don't know if they did it there, but over here, a lot of channels played like classic games, classic football, baseball, basketball games from the past. And it was kind of fun. I got to show some of the favorite games from my childhood to my son for the first time, who hadn't seen some of these, and that was kind of cool. But yeah, it needed sports to get going. And boy, other than that, how have I been killing time? I played a lot of golf this summer. I actually went from being a terrible golfer to just a mediocre golfer, which was a huge leap up in class, I guess. So you know, that's nice. It was a good year to have a public golf course just a few hundred yards away. So I could walk out my front door and be beside the 15th green in less than a minute. And, you know, that was sort of nice to have, be able to get that fresh air and, you know, not making the long commute to the office every day, a lot more free time to golf. So I'm grateful for that, I guess.
Pat, I think you might have done yourself a disservice by saying mediocre. What is your handicap right now?
I don't have a registered handicap, but I'd say, you know, pre-pandemic, it probably would have been like 20 or something. And maybe now I could play to like a 13 or a 14.
That's good. That's good. The average in the UK, if you are below an 18 handicap, you're considered better than average. So You're better than average, Pat. Come on.
A lot better than average. So yeah. You're not only the world's greatest fantasy ranker, but you're also an above average golfer.
Yeah, I don't know if there are a lot of golfers who I would not be fit to play at a foursome with, but you know, I'll take the improvement, I guess.
I always remember, I think the first time I really came across you was on the Fantasy Pros podcast with Tags, where you had Tags on your show, but I think it was across them both. I think you both came on each other's podcast in a short period of time. Yes. A couple of years ago, and you talked about golf then. What's Tags like as a golfer? I mean, do you guys, you know, I know you don't get to play a lot, but would you say you'd beat him in a skins game?
No. So I'm trying to think of whether it was two or three times where we've actually played rounds together. And then this year we met. We always do this the week, just the first week of the NFL season. We do it like a couple days before that Thursday kickoff, like our last chance to sneak this in before we know we're both going to be really busy. Him especially, you know, going probably 80 to 100 hours a week during the season. So yeah, we live not far from each other. And we get together for a round, and Tags is definitely better than I am, and Tags hits it a mile. Like, Tags is a strong dude. So he hits it a long way. And this year we just went to this place. I don't know if they have Topgolf there. It's just sort of like a combination of a bar and a driving range. Mm-hmm. And like, you can play these little games where you're shooting at targets and for a contest. I've never beaten Tags on the golf course. I think I beat him at this place, but in his defense, the pandemic kept him home with his like toddler age son constantly. So he didn't play golf all spring or summer, like not one round. So Tags was completely out of practice while I was playing like four or five rounds every week. So not really a fair contest there.
But that's what he told you. Secretly he was sneaking off in between parenting roles, and he was just using that as his whole, you know, he's basically doing a Doug Peterson with the whole I want to win thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Benching. Yeah.
Exactly. The daycares weren't really closed. That was all just an excuse.
Yeah, exactly that. Let's take it for what it is. Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of you know, lasting on the pandemic. Any new hobbies? You mentioned you watched some old games, but have you learned anything or done anything that perhaps you would never have had the time to do before that you've ended up taking up and enjoying?
Boy, not really. A lot of it was dedicated to the golf, like that, especially during the football season when I had any free extra time. And luckily, like we're kind of, I'm in Illinois, so the northern part of the country, and fall can be kind of inclement at times. And we had a really nice fall. So basically, when I wasn't working at the day job or fantasy, I was golfing, you know, or occasionally spending time with my wife and kids too, I suppose. But so, yeah, I mean, now that the season's over and there's a little more downtime, I've got some books lined up. It'll be nice to read a book again. That tends to not happen during football season. And that's about it. Have not picked up a guitar and learned to play yet, unfortunately. I should probably do that at some point. That's on the bucket list. But, yeah, so that's about it. We'll see what it brings now without, you know, weekly football.
Yeah. Very much so. Before we move on to football, Pat, if you do manage to make it over to London and you find yourself with a free morning or afternoon, I work on a golf course and it's 10 minutes up the road from Merv, 10 minutes from my house. So if you make it over to London, we can get you on a train out to the suburbs and we can get you around a golf at my golf course. Absolutely.
We talked about that last time, Stocks. I would love to play. I've played a lot of, I've actually done 3 golf trips to Scotland, but I've never played anywhere in England. So I would love to see some of the courses there.
Right. Well, we'll make that happen. I will probably just either caddy or drink.
You can do both of those things at the same time.
That's perfect. Right.
Then that is my role. I mean, golf has been one of those things, and I lived in Florida and never got the proper time to do it properly and just never had the time to really just pick it. And I'd love to one day. Maybe I can learn when we're not in a pandemic and do that. But yeah. I think I wouldn't want to hold you two gentlemen up, so I'll keep score and caddy and drink. I think they're the things. Counting and drinking are like two of the top 3 things I can do in this world. So
you would be a perfect golf companion.
Yeah, exactly. But let's talk about the 2020 season. It is in the books. It's done. In terms of from a fantasy football / regular season perspective. So how did you get on this year in terms of your leagues and any titles, any noteworthy victories this year?
No, it was an absolutely horrid season for me, as well as it went with the weekly rankings. Like my teams just were terrible. Boy, what was it? I probably had like 5th between Dynasty, Redraft, the tournament leagues I do in like yours and the Scott Fishbowl, probably about 15 teams. 2 semifinals, 1 final, and that was a loss. Well under 500. Just a really bad season. Just seemed like one of those years where I was among the leaders, if not the leader, in opponent points against in every redraft league. I can't really say that injuries hit me harder than anyone else, but it was just kind of one of those tough years. Lose a lot of close games. Really good luck, actually, with injuries for the first 4 or 5 weeks, where I was thinking, like, okay, I've had some bad luck, but I can come back because at least my teams are healthy. And then the injuries hit in a big wave and sort of finished off, dashed the hope of recovery. So, yeah, it was kind of a strangely bad season. And strangely, that sounds arrogant, but it just, normally I finish like a little over 500 at least, and well below 500 this year. It was kind of a disaster.
Yeah, I think I'd love to meet the person that went 500 across multiple leagues this year, because I think like you had an extreme. Everyone I've spoken to has either finished below 500 by quite a bit or about 500 by quite a bit, yet to meet anyone that really was around 500. I think you either had teams that just took off and accelerated, or you had teams that just absolutely tanked.
I reckon I was pretty much on the bubble of 500. I haven't worked. Yeah, I had a couple of teams went undefeated and then lost in the final, and then I had a couple of teams which went like 1-14, or just so they balanced each other out. And then pretty much all my other teams, we had a couple of joint teams that were sort of 10 and something, but everything else was like 7 and 7 and 9 or the other way around and stuff. So I reckon I could be the closest to 500, you know.
I mean, yeah, we had a lot of our combined teams, we had a lot of 7 and 6, 6 and 7 teams. Yeah. But yeah, it was an interesting year for sure. Was there anything in particular, Pat, that you noticed from your teams or just in general that, and I mean, we'll do a deep dive in a minute, but
sure.
In terms of just that you're going to park away and think I'm going to take that into 2021 in terms of immediate insight or just a top level thing that you think from the teams that you built?
I do think, and though I don't have as many teams as you have, Murph, when you have like more than a dozen teams, I do think diversification is a good strategy. And I maybe did not diversify my roster enough. And part of that might be because it seemed like I never drew a draft spot in the middle of the draft, which is kind of generally where I like to draft from. It seemed like I was either top three or four or bottom three in all my drafts. And it seemed to lead to me picking a lot of the same guys in the first three or four rounds. And so I was grossly overweight on George Kittle this year, which really hurt me. I maybe banked a little too hard on a Joe Mixon rebound year, which hurt me. Just wasn't able to mix the portfolio quite as much as I normally do. Generally, I just, you know, I care more about in draft season avoiding the landmine players, the guys I just feel like are falling knives that I don't want to catch, and just stay away from those guys. And then all the guys who I'm not opposed to drafting, mix and match and get, you know, at least a little bit of representation with, you know, each of those guys. And I didn't do a good enough job of that this year, and it kind of cost me.
Well, I think it was a strange year because it was from the point of the drafts themselves, like I found that this year going into 2020, there were really clear tiers, probably more so than ever. In most positions, you had really, really clear tiers that everybody kind of stuck to. So it got to the point that in most drafts, the first two rounds, there wasn't much diversification. Most people took McCaffrey at one, Barkley at two, and then your real flip point was Zeke or Kamara at 3-4. Then you'd have your Cook, Thomas in the 5 to 6 range, and then you'd have Adams, Hill, Mixon, Chubb, and all the like. And you really didn't. The only interesting points were who was taking Kelce and Kittle. And then people, you know, would try and buck the trend, like a D-Hop might go slightly earlier, which would have paid off for people early at least. But you were kind of like, I found like most first rounds were pretty identical, give or take a couple of picks aside. Like it was almost like an auto draft. And I thought that was really strange because I think in all the years I play fantasy football, it's not been like that. CEH was the only one that made it interesting late with his late surge in price. I don't think I've ever seen a static board like it was, where there was so little movement between. Maybe the fact there wasn't a preseason probably played a lot into that.
Yeah, that's a good point about the lack of a preseason really not changing things much. And maybe that was the other thing I took away, that I might have followed the herd a bit too much on draft strategy with largely the consensus to collect a couple of running backs and then take advantage of the wide receiver depth and start pounding the wide receiver position. And I sort of followed that, and maybe it's a bad sign when so many people are doing the same thing, like it's time to get off and try a different approach and differentiate yourself a little bit. I should have done more of that.
I think as well, though, is you both made points that sort of bring my point together, is that this was the first time that I'd done any projection ranking before the season had started. So I'd created my projections and that for giving me my ranks and tiers that Murph and I put in our book, and then I had it in front of me, and I was really pleased with how mine came out. A lot of them were boom picks, but I thought if I'm going to win, I want to win by picking these guys. And I think because, as Murph said, and Pat said as well, people took the same sort of players and there wasn't much diversification. And because I was so into my picks and nothing really changed, and I picked a lot from the turn quite often at the end of the draft, I ended up with a lot of the first 5-6 rounds. My guys were the guys I was going after and I was getting them. So a lot of my teams looked the same to start with, like you both said. And then because there wasn't any diversification, I didn't really feel the need to flip-flop because my guys were still there and I was all in on them. So the people I obviously busted on hurt me all over the place as well.
I think that that's a thing I always say, and people sort of kill me for this over and over again. I just don't have that many my guys. I just don't. I don't have that many guys. I have maybe two, maybe three a season. And I always am someone who's looking to create a spread. The strategy will go how the strategy goes. And I did a lot of RBRB, but I noticed trends very quickly and picked up Mike Davis and busted my fab really early on guys like Davis, James Robinson. And those guys, massive, because I went from having a team where I lost a Christian McCaffrey or I lost Joe Mixon or I lost, a running back who just wasn't producing, and then was getting guys off the waiver wire who were then my guys for the rest of the year and carried me through, like a Robinson, like a Davis, and got me through the filler that I was kind of stuck. And then if I had guys that were out for periods of time that would come back, they kind of get me going. Guys like Todd Gurley, I had more Todd Gurley than I thought I did. And, you know, for the first 8 weeks of the season, he was terrific. He got me through those ridiculously hard. I thought the first half of the season was really hard because of all the games and the bye week schedules. But I think it was interesting, the lack of diversification. And I think the teams that did well really attacked the waiver wire in those first 2 or 3 weeks. Key that those guys stuck around like Davis. No one was picking Davis up in week three, sure, thinking, oh, he's going to last until week 16. You thought, I might get 5 games out of Mike Davis, and if I win 4 of those games, I'm set for the playoffs. And that was my strategy. I put a lot of money in on him, and it paid off. But if I look back at my drafts, like the Warrior, so there was a 240-man tournament called the Warrior Bowl, which I came runner-up in, and my draft is atrocious. Like, I look back on it, and the draft is really bad. But I absolutely ran the table on the waiver wire and picked up 5-6 really good blokes that just got me through into the final, who all hit. And that was literally the difference, was if I played with the team I drafted, I'd have been out early, really early, because I missed on so many guys. But I just reacted quickly to the waiver wire, and I think this was the year that the waiver wire kind of came back, because the last 2 years it's been a bit flat. But what I'm interested in doing is part of this is doing a bit of a deep dive and just trying to get some trends from like a really top level perspective and look at each major position and see if there was anything that kind of stuck out to you, Pat, that, okay, how do we improve in 2021 and get ourselves some more ships? So what do you think about quarterback? Was there anything that really stuck out to you with quarterback this year that is going to make you rethink some strategy in 2021?
Yeah, in fact, maybe the biggest sea change at all, I think, and of all in my overall strategy. Like, I think the late round quarterback idea kind of died this year. Like, I don't think you can really afford to be as patient at quarterback anymore, just because there is a just such a divide between the top tier and the second class. Like, I mean, in a lot of ways, if you look at Phillip Rivers' performance this season, it was good. I think the Colts would say that they were pleased, and the surface passing numbers looked pretty appealing. I mean, for the last basically half of the season, he would average what, 270 passing yards a game and 2 touchdown passes, and generally those are the kind of numbers you're happy with if you're throwing a guy out there. But he added nothing whatsoever in the running game, so most of those weeks when he was consistently putting up those 270-yard, 2-touchdown games, he was finishing as a quarterback too, out of the top 12. And, I mean, now you've just got, you've got the elite pure passer like Patrick Mahomes. You've got these runners like Lamar Jackson, Deshaun Watson, Josh Allen, Kyler Murray, you know, a new class of, well, Dak Prescott, who was, you know, breaking football before he was hurt. Jalen Hurts looks like he's going to be another dynamic runner to add next year. And then, you know, the guys who don't run that much, but run a little and are terrific passers like Aaron Rodgers. Looks like maybe Justin Herbert is ready to join that class. So you've got about 11 or 12 of those guys. I think if you throw in like Trevor Lawrence next year, who I'm convinced is going to be pretty terrific right from the start, I think you need to get one of those guys. I don't think you can just afford to sit back and say, well, I'll just go with Jared Goff for a while and maybe try waivers. You can play matchups in a pinch and pick someone off waivers and stream the position. But I kind of think you need to now get one of those heavy hitters at quarterback to keep up. And sacrificing a fifth or a sixth round draft pick to do it, I used to think there were better ways to spend that fifth or sixth round draft pick. And I don't think I'm going to be approaching 2021 that way.
I couldn't agree more. I've said it already on here that I think if you look at your quarterback was almost a league winner for you down the stretch. I mean, if you took Josh Allen in the seventh round this year, you're laughing all the way to the bank. Yes. He returned his ADP and then some. Aaron Rodgers, you would have got for an eighth round pick again. You'd have been delighted with him. Kyler Murray was going in the sixth. You'd have been happy with him. Mahomes is the only one. If him and Jackson didn't return their ADPs as much, but I mean, Mahomes didn't kill you. He was right up there and probably would have been the QB1 on the season or would have been right up there. But I notice there's kind of two tiers of quarterback now, and maybe Justin Herbert's maybe the bridge between the two, where you've got Allen, Rodgers, Murray, Mahomes, Watson from the season, and maybe even Wilson. He was kind of like there or there. He sort of dropped off at the end there. I also don't think his rushing yardage is sustainable, because he put up 500 yards rushing this year, and I can see that regressing slightly. So
sure,
he's kind of on that cusp. But that top five, I think, is a hard one to break into. And then your next tier of Wilson, Tannehill, Brady, Herbert, Jackson were kind of like, they were your guys. You could play with any of those 10 and you were pretty set. And anything from there, you were massively behind the eight ball. Maybe Kirk Cousins, but no one drafted him. You picked him up late and he got some late points down the stretch. Those that took Matt Ryan, as you say, Jared Goff, they were the ones that really hurt you. Matt Stafford, a lot of people were in on Matt Stafford. He would have really hurt you this year if you took him. And I also noticed a lot of people took and kept spare quarterbacks on their benches. It was very hard to stream quarterbacks this year, because normally you'd find sort of five or six guys you could pick up on the waiver wire with less 30% ownership. But actually there was only one, two guys, because everyone was stashing a quarterback this year, mostly probably due to COVID or I don't know what, but I don't know. Did you find a similar sort of thing?
It did seem that way. Like people were more inclined to take two quarterbacks this year. And I do think maybe part of that was just it seemed like a lot of leagues would add a couple of roster spots this year, sort of adjust for what they knew was going to be in a regular year. Maybe that was part of it, but it did seem like it was harder than ever to stream the position. And I found that out the hard way, since I did wait on quarterbacks a lot and found myself stuck with Phillip Rivers or Gardner Minshew or Jimmy Garoppolo in some of these leagues, and had to try to move off these guys. And it was hard to find serviceable replacements on waivers.
Yeah. I think the only two late round quarterbacks I think that kind of got away with were Tannehill and Brady. I think they were the only two that if you picked them up, you probably did reasonably well.
Sure. Yeah. They weren't even sort of, they were later round, but I don't think they were the really, for the people who really like to cut corners at the position, I don't think there were any corners to be cut.
No. Herbert was the only guy if you got him off waivers.
Fitzmagic did a bit as well down early on, but he would have been going later because of the Tua worry. Even though Tua was never going to be the starter, there was always the concern that he'd take away Fitz's job earlier, so people weren't drafting him as early as maybe they would have done if Tua wasn't going to start the season or start half the season.
I had that in the championship team where I had that. I went with Fitzpatrick because quarterbacks went far too early for the prices within the bay. And I was like, right, I'm kind of stuck. And I took Herbert with my last pick, thinking, well, I reckon that sea change is going to happen at some point where they're going to bring in Tua. And I hope that Justin Herbert is playing before Tua plays. And that's kind of what happened, and it paid off. But that wasn't a strategy based on skill. It was purely just what was available on the board, and it was luck.
Yeah, and a couple weeks in, it was like, I think some people were wondering whether Herbert was, you know, this good, if it was for real. And I think the game that woke people up, oddly enough, was I want to say it was week 5 against your Buccaneers. Was it not when he went into Tampa and
he was terrific.
Yeah. 3 or 4 touchdowns, a couple of long ones. Yeah. I think that was the game where people realized that this was not a fluke with him.
Yeah. He took on a top eight defense and he was terrific in that first half. He was very unfortunate that, you know, there was a fumble and then there was a touchdown right before the half that kind of let out the Buccaneers to stay in it. And then they scored with the first, they did the double dip, scored right at the end of the first half, scored right at the beginning of the second. Then the momentum just completely changed. They got an interception, another turnover, and that was it. And then from there, it was like, it was just an immountable climb, but really they should have won that game. And Herbert was terrific. The long ball to Guyton, it was like 80 yards or something, was terrific. It was as good a ball thrown in the NFL this year. And I think you're right. I think that was the announcement of Herbert, and I thought this kid... And it's interesting because if you'd asked me this time last year, I would have said Justin Herbert has all the makings of a first-round bust. I looked at him and thought... I looked at the tape. I thought he was wooden. I thought he was very static, didn't really escape the pocket. And then actually, he was one of the few players when I saw the Senior Bowl, when he got the MVP in the Senior Bowl, and then you saw the Combine, you saw... Take out the... And these Pro Day, and you actually thought... There's a lot of things he does not put on tape. And I thought, was it scheme? Was it Oregon just deliberately kept him in the pocket and restricted him? Or was it a case of he had all of this and just didn't know how to use it and he needed the coach to bring it out? And it was only really in the process I thought, he's got something. And I took him in a lot of rookie drafts thinking, I think, you know, he's a safe bet. I think he could do something. I didn't expect him to be as good as he was, but... I thought I liked him as a safe bet of, especially in the Superflex League, let's see what you've got. If it doesn't work out, it's not a problem. You can probably still trade him because he'll be a starter and you'll probably get something back. And it's panned out. But he was one that a year ago I would have gone absolutely nowhere. Could not see him doing anything in the NFL because it just looks too static.
Right. No, as late as, you know, as recently as a calendar year ago when he played my school in the Rose Bowl. On January 1st, Wisconsin versus Oregon. You know, they Oregon barely won. I think he had 2 rushing touchdowns and hurt Wisconsin far more as a runner than as a passer. Like, he kind of didn't scare you as a Wisconsin fan watching that game at any point. You know, even though there was just clearly evident arm talent and I had seen it from him in other games. But yeah, I mean, he has just made unbelievable strides this year, and you know, clearly he's going to be at the, you know, near the top of the position for quite a while.
There's not been a better first season other than Mahomes, but obviously it wasn't his rookie year, but there hasn't been a better first season from a quarterback in recent memory that I can recall, and playing on such a bad team, and I still don't know why they're bad. If someone was to sit here and say how the Chargers only win 5 or 6 games, I couldn't tell you. I genuinely don't understand how that team has done as badly as it has with all the talent and weapons that it has.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how the Herbert 2020 season compares to the Trevor Lawrence 2021 season, because Lawrence he's really good. I mean, he's I think the best maybe can't miss quarterback prospect since Andrew Luck. And you know, I think he's going to be good right away.
But do you think with Lawrence it's a case of, I mean, the landing spot for Herbert, as Murph said, with the Chargers was absolutely phenomenal. I mean, the weapons they had and the defense to go alongside that offense could have got Herbert out of a bit of trouble if the defense needed to make some plays on that side of the ball. Whereas Joe Burrow, bless him, went number one overall to the Bengals team, which needs some work. And is Trevor Lawrence going to do the same thing going to the Jags, where they've got some weapons, but they don't have the offense and defense the Chargers have? If Trevor Lawrence is that good and he makes that much of a difference, he's going to be outstanding because he doesn't have the weapons to go to in Jacksonville.
Well, I mean, I guess I like LaVisca Chenault a lot, and I think DJ Chark is pretty good. And, you know, even Colin Johnson flashed a little bit this year as a lower drafted, or yeah, I think he was a 7th rounder maybe. So, like, I don't hate the receiving weapons, and their offensive line isn't that bad at all. And it might actually not be the worst thing for him, or at least from a fantasy perspective, that the Jacksonville defense is probably going to be wretched again next year. That's probably going to force him to be in a lot of shootouts. So I think the rookie setup for Trevor Lawrence could be pretty ideal from a fantasy standpoint. You know, and just the talent is there, and he runs too. Like, he's not a Kyler Murray or a Lamar Jackson, certainly, but he's aggressive running for touchdowns when he needs to. You know, I think he's going to be a guy more of a slightly less aggressive, slightly less reckless Josh Allen. I think he's going to run a lot like Josh Allen did this year when Allen was a little smarter about things, where he still gives you some touchdowns. Maybe, you know, not the sort of rushing yardage that Lamar Jackson is going to give you or Kyler Murray will, but, you know, those rushing touchdowns are important. And I think you're going to get some out of him on top of, you know, him being an excellent passer.
Yeah, I agree.
Sorry, Murph. Yeah, I agree too. I was just playing devil's advocate. Pat, Murph and I talked about rather where would he rather go at the time. It was the Jets or the Jags, and no one was really sure who the number one overall pick was. And we had a conversation about weapons and team and everything like that. And for me, it was the Jags over the Jets. If I had to choose one of those two to go to be their quarterback, it was Jags all day long.
It's not even close. Like, as you said, the wide receiver call, you miss Keelan Cole. I think he's also a very underrated receiver on that team.
He's a free agent, I think. I don't know. They might re-sign him, of course, but I do think he's an unrestricted free agent. I think Chris Conley might be too.
Yeah, I think Conley might go, and Dede Westbrook will go. I reckon they might keep Cole. I think they can give him a contract to stay, because I think they've always had high hopes for him, and they've always – he just took a bit of time to put it all together. But I know that he was someone that they were hopeful would be a pretty useful player. And I think
he was indeed this year, yeah.
He made a lot of big plays, and I think that's a great core. You've got James Robinson, who I think is I don't think he's going to put the same season up again, especially with Lawrence, but I think he's going to be – he can move the chains. He's a tough, tough guy, and I think if they can keep that core together – I think Lawrence is definitely going to do something next year. And you couldn't say that at the Jets. I mean, I still think personally for me, I wouldn't take Fields if I was the Jets. I just think you're compounding and doubling down on the same mistake you did with Darnold in you take a quarterback instead of taking weapons that are going to improve your team. The quarterback situation isn't great there, but it's not the whole problem. It's not even half the problem. It's if you take Fields and you don't get a better O-line and better protection around the quarterback, Fields is going to fail anyway. It doesn't matter who you take. So I would personally urge the Jets to pass on Fields and take Sewell, but I guess we'll see what happens.
It's interesting. Yeah, it sort of echoes the position that the Cardinals were in a couple years ago with Kyler Murray, looking at him after drafting Josh Rosen. And some people said, why don't you try to develop Rosen? And I know it's not the same comp, but obviously they made the right decision by going for the quarterback, you know, the second first round quarterback in as many years. And it turned out to be the right choice, I think. But I do think Darnold has a better future than Josh Rosen did. And I do think Justin Fields is less of a sure thing than Kyler Murray was. Although, yeah, I think it probably sealed it when Justin Fields had a terrific game and actually outplayed Trevor Lawrence in that bowl game the other night. Fields was just fantastic in that game. So I think that probably seals him as the number two.
Interesting. I guess we'll see what happens. But I think the quarterback position is definitely up for grabs next year. And I think a lot of people won't sleep. So you're looking at the board now. Let's say, for example, people are still going to go early on Mahomes. I mean, he's still going to go in, say, the third round. Are you still inclined to pass on him if that's his price tag? And then if so, that group of, say, Allen, Rodgers, Murray, what round, one, do you think they'll go, and two, you would be comfortable paying the price for if they're on the board at, say, the start of a round?
Yeah, so I'm having a difficult time picturing, like, what round these guys go in, especially since I tend to be in some of these industry leagues where people wait more than usual. You know, I don't know that I would want to go any later than the sixth or seventh. I have a feeling I'm going to end up with Jalen Hurts in a lot of leagues because I'll be ready to confidently put him in the top 10 next year, and I'm not sure other people will be. And I'll probably wind up with some Trevor Lawrence too, because I'm actually not afraid to roll with him as my quarterback one right away. But don't think I want to let that position get away from me past about the seventh round. Like, that would be as far as I'd want to push it.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what the price check is on some of these players. I think the third is going to be too much for any quarterback. The fifth round, if Kyler or Josh Allen are there, that's mighty tempting now.
Sure. And I think we saw third was kind of where Mahomes and Lamar Jackson were going this year. And I think we saw that was probably too early. Like the people who took those guys early in the third round, I would say most likely regret it.
Yeah. And unless you hit round one, round two. If you took Dalvin Cook and try to think of a round two player that would have come off good for you, maybe D-Hop, maybe Tyreek Hill if he fell far enough. And then you got Mahomes, you probably did okay. But that would be a really small window of people.
And I think as well, I think Aaron Rodgers is going to be, if he carries on at this pace and does eventually win the MVP, if they go on and he can win the MVP and they get to their draft and they're drafting at the back end of the first or last in the first, there's no way if they don't get another wide receiver somehow, there's absolutely no way they pass on a wide receiver if there isn't talent there at the end of the first. There's no way that Aaron Rodgers doesn't carry on being the quarterback of Green Bay.
Wait, you're telling me they're not going to take Kyle Trask in the first round this year?
Well, they might. They might, but
I'm just saying, you know, that third quarterback spot is really tempting to invest in this year.
I mean, if they go ahead and they draft a Rashad Bateman or a Jalen Waddle or someone like that, I mean, you give Aaron Rodgers someone else alongside Devontae Adams, it's lights out. I mean, they're playing so well right now, and yes, it's another season on and stuff like that, but I think Rodgers could be an eighth round steal next year.
Yeah, you're getting my hopes up, Stocks, as a Packers fan with all this talk about these great college wide receivers joining Aaron Rodgers' side. That would just, yes, it sounds so good.
If they draft Bateman, that's it. Absolute. I'm man crush. He'll be my LaVisca Chenault of next year. I cannot wait. If they draft Bateman,
he's fantastic.
Oof. So let's move the conversation on to running backs. Now, it was a really tough year for running backs this year with, you know, three of the top four not producing at all, really, through injury or just all round, just not really delivering. That's unfair to say of Zeke. I mean, he did technically finish as an RB1, but I mean, not what you drafted or paid for at a position. Do we think that two things? One, that the top four is perhaps bigger than the top four now, and is there a difference in order given what we've seen this year? And do we think that running back is too risky a play given the amount of turnover and injuries at the position, as well as also too much of the running back by committee that's popping up?
Yeah, I think that is sort of a consideration, just that the predictability of the position has to weigh in at some point. And knowing that at wide receiver, more so than with running back a little bit, you get what you pay for. Like if we go, I was looking at my rankings going into the season last year, and at the running back position, I had in the 90s, let me just call this up here. I had guys like Miles Gaskin, Jeff Wilson, number 92. Miles Gaskin, 93. Mike Davis, 95. Wayne Gallman, 102. Obviously, these guys were their ascension, with the exception of Gaskin, who I think was sort of the surprise starter for the Dolphins. Just no one kind of saw that coming, and everyone thought it would be this messy committee. And, you know, he started out as a featured back right away. But with him being the exception from that group, like all those guys you talked about, Mike Davis cashing in on the CMC injury, you know, Wayne Gallman had Saquon go down and then Devonta Freeman go down in front of him. So, but we see that happen with running backs every year, guys who aren't necessarily extraordinary talents. I mean, let's face it, Mike Davis is serviceable, but like he's not an extraordinary talent, but circumstances can push those guys to extraordinary value in fantasy football. And we see less of it at wide receiver. I mean, it's not unheard of. Nelson Agholor, I think, was outside my top 100 in the rankings last year and wound up being a pretty valuable player. Guys like Tim Patrick and Travis Fulgham briefly had significant value this year, but it happens far more often at running back. And, you know, that should be one consideration. But the other consideration, I think, is that the position actually looks a lot deeper. You know, I've put together some rough rankings. I'm not going to finalize them for another day or two, but like I've got David Montgomery down at running back 21, actually, for next year. You know, I am fading him a little bit. That's part of that. But
yeah,
It goes a legitimate 20 to 25 guys deep, like guys I'd actually feel pretty good about starting next year. I mean, guys like James Robinson down in the late teens. You know, there J.K. Dobbins, as much as I love him, I couldn't get him in the top 12. So, like, it does appear to be a deeper position with this infusion of youth we've gotten in the last couple of years. And there's more of that on the way with, you know, Travis Etienne and Najee Harris and some other interesting rookies. So, you know, it does look a little deeper. So I think it's going to be maybe a good year to not go running back right at the start.
Yeah. I have to ask you a question because I know you're a massive fan, especially as a Badger, of Jonathan Taylor. Where do you have him next year and why? I'm keen.
I've got him 6 behind what? McCaffrey, Cook, Kamara, Barkley, and Derrick Henry. So
you've made me look really stupid by saying that.
Why is that, Murph?
He's having a chat with one of our writers, Nick, who's a massive... Now, listen, first of all, I'm going to preface this by saying...
I genuinely think Murph just had a power cut.
I saw that. He went dark.
He's gone half dark on his screen, Rush Nation, and he's gone off the PC. So whether Murph will be back, Pat, it could just be me and you now for the rest of the show. I hope you're okay with that because Murph was just about to get into his Jonathan Taylor track with Nick. Basically, Murph doesn't think he gets enough touches to be a running back one, and Nick is a huge Jonathan Taylor truther. Do you think he's going to get enough touches? You obviously do. But why do you think he's going to get enough touches with Nyheim Hines still there being the receiving back?
I do. And I was very frustrated myself by the Colts. That's one guy I invested heavily in, like over-invested. I talked about that earlier on, maybe putting too much into certain guys. And Taylor was certainly one of those guys. And it was frustrating early on when he was in a 3-man committee, essentially, with Nyheim Hines and Jordan Wilkins. But they did eventually cut Wilkins out of that, and they did sort of use Hines more as a passing down back. I mean, early in the season, they were giving Hines goal line carries, which seems just extraordinarily stupid to me when I've seen, you know, Jonathan Taylor punch in dozens of short yardage touchdowns at Wisconsin. So I do think they kind of came to their senses with his usage. And though his schedule was pretty favorable over the last half of the season, I mean, we saw him do it to even, you know, a good Pittsburgh defense in week 16 and scored 2 touchdowns and win some people championships. So, I am not too worried about the workload. And, you know, in this era, there are not too many guys we can count on for 20 touches every single week. Mm-hmm. You know, it is sort of the committee era, but I think Taylor has enough of a chokehold on that backfield now, where he's clearly like the 1A at very least, and like he can still survive Nyheim Hines cutting into his workload a bit and still put up running back 1 numbers.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, we saw it at Wisconsin, just how good he was. And I think it just took the Colts a little longer than perhaps we thought it might to make him the 1A of the running back committee. And he's such a bludgeon at the goal line that it would be silly not to use him and keep that three-headed monster going. I think that we've seen it, like you said, against Pittsburgh. And then did they play Pittsburgh yesterday or the day? But no.
Week 16.
Yeah, and then on week 17, he had an absolute monster, 200-odd yards. Yeah, he's definitely got the skills. I mean, there was I wrote an article sort of mid-draft season, I said, and my suggestion was not to go running back if you were drafting at the 12th turn, 10 or 12th turn. Take two wide receivers, because at that point, CEH and Gurley were there in the third, fourth. And I was saying if you could get Tyreek Hill and Devontae Adams at the end of the first, start of the second, and then get Gurley and maybe CEH or a David Montgomery in third, fourth, you were in a real good stead.
Oh, very, very prescient stocks. That was a very outstanding call. I mean, if anyone would have done that, they would have been set for success for sure, especially if it was Adams, Hill, and Montgomery. What a start that would have been.
Yeah, especially if you were managed, or if you got Montgomery and Gurley and you managed to flip-flop Gurley for someone like James Robinson or a Mike Davis after his early start, and you managed to flip Gurley for a bit of a decent price midway through sort of week six or week seven, I think you were absolutely laughing. But do you think going wide receiver, considering it is the deepest position on the board, do you think that's a potential option in 2021 after what you just said?
I do, given the depth and the fact that I think you can get decent running backs that you can feel pretty good about in the third and fourth round. You know, I feel pretty confident about the guys in the top 25 at running back, and knowing that, you know, you would be able to get at least one of those guys, if not two, if you waited and didn't take a receiver in the first, or didn't take a running back in the first two rounds. So I do think it's viable. I also think there's kind of a drop off from maybe, I don't know, I've got after about 13 or so, like I think there's kind of a dip, 13 or 14, right around Keenan Allen, Mike Evans. And then I think there's a little bit of a dip in quality where you have to take a bit of a leap of faith. Guys I like, certain things have to go right for them. Like DJ Moore, I like a lot, but he's got to start scoring touchdowns at some point. Terry McLaurin, who's a terrific player, but is somehow, you know, somewhat handicapped by his quarterback situation. You know, Adam Thielen, who's getting older. Robert Woods, who's, you know, steady, but maybe just doesn't have that wide receiver one upside. So, you know, I do think there's sort of a discernible drop from the mid-teens. I think there are actually more than 12 like wide receiver one types, but then, you know, it drops off pretty quickly. And if you can get two of those guys and maybe, you know, two of the truly elite guys like, you know, the Metcalfs, and if you could somehow pair a Tyreek Hill with a Metcalf in the first two rounds, like start me off with that sort of duo at wide receiver. And yeah, I'm happy to make do at running back.
Do you think, obviously, you've done a little bit of research being a college fan, do you think Ja'Marr Chase is the best wide receiver we've seen in years coming out of LSU? I mean, obviously, you said Trevor Lawrence is as good as prospect you've seen since Andrew Luck. And everything I've heard and watched so far on Chase, he seems to be the real deal. And I've heard few people comp him to the best thing we've seen since Julio Jones. And that's quite a compliment.
It is. I guess I don't feel as strongly about him being so far head and shoulders above recent number one receivers as I do with Lawrence, because I thought so highly of CeeDee Lamb last year, of, you know, like DK Metcalf, even though he was sort of
one dimensional.
Yeah, I mean, we were sort of wish casting, I think, when he was drafted, but like there was obviously immense physical talent that had the potential to be tapped. I'm trying to think of who were some of the other wide receiver mega prospects lately. Yeah, I mean, maybe he is like the best in a while. And I do think he's going to be considered the clear wide receiver one in this class. Yeah, I kind of landing spot's going to be really interesting with him. And, you know, it's possible he gets undervalued a little just because he was out of sight, out of mind, and we didn't see him play football in 2020. So, but yeah, he's such an exciting prospect. There's just so much to like about him.
Yeah, he really is. I think it would be somewhat poetic if he managed to land at Cincinnati when they move on from AJ Green. I know they drafted T. Higgins, but he is predominantly an outside guy. You know, he's from the hashes outwards to the numbers, lets the sideline do the work. He goes up and gets jump balls and stuff. But I think if you gave them T. Higgins on the outside, then you've got, if you give him back Ja'Marr Chase, Joe Burrow, all barring that he comes back fit. Because he plays all over the field, Chase. And I think if you gave Burrow Chase back, that would be very exciting for what we saw from Burrow this year.
Oh, Burrow with Chase and T. Higgins on the outside and mm-hmm. Tyler Boyd in the slot. I mean, that would just be... That would get Bengal fans excited, like irrationally excited, and I could totally understand it.
Yep, and I could totally see them doing it as well because they want to give their boy Joe Burrow the weapons to go out and succeed. It's obviously that franchise does things a little differently as we've seen in the past, but it's definitely a move I can see them doing with what happened to Burrow. Like, you don't want your shiny toy getting injured, so how can we make that a bit better? I know, we'll get your best friend from college in and you can go back out and tear it up, but I am completely in agreement with you that you can do wide receiver. And I think it would be a prudent move if you can get value depending on mock drafts and stuff you've done. And I think it also hugely depends on what time of the season you're drafting. But somebody like Michael Thomas, Pat, where obviously the season he had was not what you were expecting when you drafted him at 6 or 7, depending on where you took him in PPR leagues. What do you think happens to him in New Orleans? Obviously, if Drew Brees retires, does that affect his draft stock or his game stock dramatically? Or if they manage to keep Drew Brees for another year and Thomas comes back healthy, is he going to be perhaps a steal, maybe late first, early second, because of what people, recency bias, we know in fantasy football is a big thing?
Yeah, it's interesting. So he, I believe, had finished wide receiver 6 in both 2017 and 2018 before he had that crazy year in 2019 and finished far away wide receiver 1. And now I've got him back at wide receiver 6. And I would certainly drop him a little bit from there if Drew Brees does retire. Although we saw Alvin Kamara's stock drop significantly with the Saints throwing to their backs less when Taysom Hill was at quarterback. But strangely enough, like, Taysom Hill almost was better for Thomas than Brees had been. You know, I think it was like one game Brees and Thomas played together before Brees got hurt. But he had a very significant target share in the games where Taysom Hill played quarterback and was still catching a lot of passes. And I think he had at least one 100-yard game in that short stretch. I mean, it was just such a washout year for Thomas, but oddly enough, I mean, he's going to be a guy that is probably going to be there in the late second round for people next year. And yeah, isn't that crazy to think of? I mean, I don't think people are going to take him ahead of Devontae Adams, Tyreek Hill, DeAndre Hopkins, Stephon Diggs, and probably not DK Metcalf either. So, that's wide receiver 6 at best. And some people might prefer Calvin Ridley or even Chris Godwin. So, yeah, strange to think that, you know, with Thomas being the break point in last year's drafts, like, he was going to be the first non-running back taken, just a question of where. And for him to be, you know, a possible late second, early third guy next year seems kind of wild.
Is there a bigger flip-flop between one season and another?
I know.
That's crazy, especially if it is early third. If he is back to fitness and either Brees or Taysom Hill is there, I think if you get him at the early third, I think he's going to cash in on his value regardless of who the quarterback is at New Orleans. I think he'll outperform his ADP at the early third.
I agree with you, Stocks. I think a lot of people will be irrationally scared away if they open with Taysom Hill as the quarterback.
Yeah. And I think that could be an even bigger steal if you could get him in the third, if you could go one of the big four running backs and then come back. And I don't know who's going to be on the board at the end of the second, but I'm trying to think of a running back. So you could go running back, and then get a Michael Thomas. Or even if you wanted to go running back and then talk about the WR stack we just talked about, if you could get, I mean, Metcalf's probably a bit too good now to be end of the second, but someone like a Godwin, or maybe even a Stephon Diggs, if you could get either of those chaps at the end of the second and then a cheeky Michael Thomas in the third, I think you're pretty much set up for picking a fourth round running back and being very happy with how your draft started.
Oh yeah, think about that. If you start 101, you could conceivably have like a McCaffrey, Michael Thomas, Calvin Ridley, or Chris Godwin starts. That's pretty phenomenal.
So it was against the Falcons, the Michael Thomas 100-yard game. I think he had 12 receptions or 15 targets or something. And it was the one game he got 28-odd points and blew up. And then everyone was like, Michael Thomas is back. And then he never played again. But somebody like Julio, the Falcons are in a bit of cap hell, as are the Saints. Julio, I guess, could be traded away now because of his age and stuff. Without Julio, how good do you think Calvin Ridley can be, and where would you conceivably take him?
Yeah, good question. So if Julio is no longer on the Falcons, I will probably push Ridley, who I now have at wide receiver 7, just behind Thomas. I would move him ahead of Thomas, certainly. And would I consider moving him ahead of Diggs? Probably not, but they would have pretty similar value. I think it would make Ridley a second-round pick for sure. You know, he showed late this past year, like he is definitely worthy of being a wide receiver 1. And certainly, even if Jones does remain with the Falcons, he is going to be picked behind Ridley next year.
Mm-hmm. 100%. I mean, we haven't even talked about him, and we've got to the start of the third round and we haven't mentioned Julio Jones, which again, in another breath, is a ridiculous statement all in itself that we haven't talked about Julio before the third round. But age waits for no man except Tom Brady, apparently, which we'll have to wait and see how that goes. But obviously, Travis Kelce, tight end 1 by a significant margin this year. And if you took him second round, I think maybe you were actually happy with that, although it was slightly early. He was a top 3 receiver up until week 16. What do we do with tight end in 2021? Are we completely punting the position now till later on in the draft, or are we still going to be taking a George Kittle, like you said, was maybe a bit early, but are Kelce and Kittle worthy of a late second, early third round pick, or are we just going to wait till later on?
I think Kelce might go in the first round of a majority of drafts next year.
First round.
I know. And, you know, there have long been people who have sort of advocated that as being the right way to go. And, you know, it certainly seemed like there was more. Well, I think the way 2020 played out is going to sort of skew the perspective on Kelce's value, because he was so far. Well, I mean, I guess maybe the gap wasn't that big between him and Darren Waller, but after those guys, there was such a big drop off. Mm-hmm. And it sort of is going to skew things a little bit, because there was no Kittle. Tight end was pretty watered down besides Kelce and Waller. And it just makes Kelce look that much more valuable. And I think people are going to take that perception of his value and transfer it to 2021. And that might be a mistake, because, you know, Kittle will be healthy again, presumably. Mm-hmm. Waller will be there. And boy, we try to talk ourselves into tight end being deep every year, and it never is. And maybe that's what I'm doing a little bit here, but there's at least hope at the position next year with, you know, Hockenson being pretty steady. And, you know, I don't know if Tanyan's value is going to hold, but, you know, Dallas Goedert, if he's, you know, the sole guy in Philadelphia, and, you know, Gronkowski even like squeezed a decent year out of him. Kyle Pitts is a rookie, an exciting rookie coming in. And I know rookie tight ends are usually a sucker play, but Kyle Pitts is pretty special. So maybe there's a little more hope at the position. And I personally would have a hard time taking Travis Kelce in the first round, unless it was a tight end premium league. But I do think he's going to go there in a lot of drafts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're talking tight end premium, there's a good case for Travis Kelce being a top 5 pick.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
I played in a, not this draft season, but the draft season before, I played in a tight end premium league with my brother-in-law. We were drafting at 8 as a joint co-op team. And I said, if Travis Kelce's there, because of how much tight ends got per reception, I said, we're taking Travis Kelce. And then I said, if George Kittle's there in the second, we're going to double down on receipt on tight end, because we can play him in the flex and then just dominate the league. And I think maybe Dalvin Cook or Derrick Henry was there, and my brother-in-law said, I can't take a tight end over either of these two. And I said, that's fine, we'll see what happens when he come back. And Travis Kelce fell to the second round and we snaffled him up. And
oh wow,
that was a bit of a steal in a tight end premium league. And I think the trouble I think we have as Brits playing fantasy football is, because we are and don't take this the wrong way, Rush Nation. I'm not being derogatory about the way we play fantasy football, but I think we are behind perhaps the Americans in the formats we play. So we're moving away from the standard format of one quarterback, two running back, two wide receivers, tight end, and a flex to super flex and IDP and tight end premium and stuff like that. But I think people are slower at the uptake of getting that when they do decide to play in a league. So they think, oh, I'll join a tight end premium league. But when the draft starts, they go into normal draft mode and forget maybe it's a super flex or a tight end premium. So the Travis Kelce's and George Kittle's fall a little bit. So there's a bit of value to be had there with them. And I think that is a big thing for me, is knowing what league you're drafting in, because that can, like, you can get a bit lost if you're not entirely sure on the scoring and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. You do have to play the format for that. And I think I've even seen a little bit of that here. Like in the Scott Fishbowl, the giant charity league here with over 1,000 entries. Those are always tight end premium leagues because Scott Fish likes tight end premium leagues. And, I played in that league for 3 or 4 years, swimming against the tide, kind of waiting on tight end before, I realized going in this year, like, I wanted to pay up and get a top tight end. Yep. Unfortunately, the one I paid up for this year was George Kittle,
so did
which
we.
Didn't work out that well for me. But, it definitely pays to, boost your level of investment if you're going to play that format.
Absolutely. I don't think it was George Kittle. We paid up for a guy we haven't even mentioned, Pat, about tight end, and that's Mark Andrews. Neither of us have mentioned his name after such a good year the year before.
I don't know how I neglected to mention him. Yeah, the clear third best tight end this year. And just a guy who's really, for the most part, except for maybe these last couple of games when Marquise Brown showed up late to the party, has been the Ravens' best pass catcher for the better part of 2 years. Mm-hmm. And just a beast in the red zone. So, yeah, he's very good. Now, another guy, like I forgot to mention in the first go around, was Noah Fant, who I think is pretty special athletically. And, if Denver gets better quarterbacking, I think he's going to be a very worthy target in the years to come.
How dare you, Pat? How dare you besmirch my Drew Lock? How dare you? No, I agree. But I think the reason we forgot Mark Andrews is, even though he was clearly the third best tight end, he didn't do his usual thing of blowing the doors off on a weekly basis. And he sort of just went a bit forgotten. Like, you had him on your lineup and you were happy starting him, but sure, there was never any, like, I need to trade for Mark Andrews because he's an elite talent. And he went under the radar for most of the season, even though he was the big red zone threat. I think that might help as well. You might be able to get a bit of a steal on Mark Andrews next year.
Yeah, he very steady, very consistent. So, yeah, the position, at least going in, seems to look a little healthier than it has been in past years, which might devalue Travis Kelce a bit. Yet everyone's going to look at Travis Kelce's 2020 value, and I think some people are going to maybe overspend a bit on him as a result.
100%. I remember, Pat, the first time you came on and we talked about ranking, you said to me, I don't know how to do it. I've got absolutely no idea how about going about projections or anything like that. And you said, well, pick a team and send me your projections and I'll do them as well and we'll see how we differ. And I never did do that. And I'm very sorry, Pat. I apologize for not sending you my rankings of a team.
Quite all right.
It took me a long time to get used to projecting teams. And I don't know, obviously we've talked about you being the number one overall ranker this year, which is an absolutely phenomenal, phenomenal achievement.
Thank you.
How do you go about your process with rankings? So for me, I do a projection of that offense against the defense for every game, and that gives me my rankings. And then rather tweak it going with my gut, so I don't get a list. I get a list of A to Z, and then that's how I use my rankings for that week. I don't then tweak it based on how I think that guy might do slightly better, because I think my gut does the work when I'm projecting the games. What is your process for ranking week to week?
Well, quite honestly, I don't even bother with projections in season because I just frankly don't have time for it. So, I go through position by position, go game by game, and just sort of start building the rankings, slotting guys one game at a time. And you know, of course, I'm looking at things as I go along, defenses, you know, various defensive metrics I like to use to gauge the caliber of the opposition, you know, the sort of trends people are on with running back and wide receiver, especially wide receiver and tight end. You have to look at snap percentage, routes run, targets, and just sort of when you look back at those in over the course of the season, you can see like trends and how playing time is trending, how targets are trending, and sort of adjusting accordingly. And, you know, of course, factoring in defenses, although I do think maybe some rankers tend to overvalue defensive matchups a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, I think basically a lot of the people who play fantasy football like to, we get into the coaching aspect of it, right? We want to feel like we've got control over our teams and that we're making moves and, you know, doing things to proactively improve our chances to win. And I think people tend to, as a result, overplay things like defensive matchups and weather a bit at times. And,
We saw that with Davante Adams against the Titans 2 weeks ago. It was a snow game and the run game was going to be phenomenal. And Derrick Henry did nothing and Davante Adams tore the pitch apart.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So, sure. But I mean, people are always asking me, should I play X inferior receiver over Y established very good receiver because of the matchup? And, you know, sometimes if the receivers are maybe a little closer, it might make sense. But, you know, when you're talking about should I sit, I don't know, what would be a good example? Robert Woods, who has a tough matchup, and play Tim Patrick instead. Like, you know, I'm just going to shut that down pretty much every time and go with the better player. But, you know, a lot of people do overplay matchups. I kind of try to avoid that while still factoring them in to some degree. Yeah, I don't know if I've changed the process all that much. It's just, you know, I guess looking at mostly the same kinds of numbers and usage trends and, you know, trying to react to things during the week. I mean, as you know, when one player goes out, that might have a ripple effect and make you change the rankings of five players on that team. Mm-hmm. You know, the top wide receiver goes out, you have to bump up three other wide receivers, bump down the quarterback, you know, possibly bump up a tight end or a running back. So, you know, just reacting to things during the week after those initial rankings are in place.
We didn't see that any more so than with Matt Stafford this year, did we? And Kenny Golladay playing and not playing.
Certainly.
I mean, certainly. The swing that they had on Golladay as a huge high draft asset that you had anyway, not playing. But then Matt Stafford going down and Marvin Jones going up and the run game in and out. And then Hockenson up and down. That was a difficult one to rank weekly just because of not having Golladay meant so many different things for that offense. I've got this image of you, Pat, with a huge board of names that you're just shuffling about up and down every week. And do you leave your, say, for instance, week one's done and you've got your list, when you hit week two, do you take everyone off the board and start again? Or do you start moving your week one rankings around, if that makes sense?
So Fantasy Pros actually gives us a nice little rankings tool, like an engine that we use to build it. And when you start the process, they say, do you want to start with the expert consensus of, I guess, people who have already done their rankings for the week? I always do mine on like Monday, so I'm among the first, and I always just start with my rankings from the previous week. But then I just sort of ignore what's in play rather than just looking at them and moving names around all over the place. I have to like kind of start, I don't know, it's just the way my strange brain works, where I just have to like clear the slate and start with the first game on the schedule, take the quarterbacks from that game, move those two quarterbacks to the top of the list. You know, even if one of the quarterbacks is Sam Darnold, you know, I'm briefly putting Sam Darnold ahead of Patrick Mahomes in my rankings until I go through all the games. So yeah, it's not like a blank board, not like it used to be in the old days when I first started ranking, when I actually would have to do it on just a blank document and start typing names out and shuffling them around. But yeah, this makes it a little bit easier, but I still like to go through and sort of, you know, erase the blackboard, if you will.
Yeah, I think I think maybe in a few years when big touch screens are an actual thing, you'll be able to do it on the screen as if you were moving the paper around on the list and just drag and drop people with your finger, which I think
that would be nice.
I think as much work as it would be to have a list of paper names and move people about and stuff on a board whilst looking at computer screens for numbers and stuff, I think there would be something very cathartic about the whole maneuvering names up and down and sliding people in and then stepping back and taking a look at it and thinking, no, I don't like him there, and moving him up to or down to. Or I think there would be something really nice about actually stepping back and looking at it rather than just staring at a screen.
Agreed. That would be fun to be able to do.
I think, yeah, I need to invest in a smart screen from a primary school or a high school or something like that. Anyway, I'm getting off track. Pat, obviously you must have been asked this question a million times, and I'm sorry for asking it, but it is a superb question for those who want to get into doing their personal rankings. Do you have any tips for those thinking about doing personal rankings at home but don't know how to begin? So when I thought about doing it, I had no idea where to even start. And then we had a conversation about projecting the offenses and stuff, and even that was a huge whirlpool for me to get lost in. Do you have any basic tips for people who want to get into doing their own rankings?
That would be this would be a good time to do it, actually, because I'm sure a lot of people are going into fantasy football withdrawal right now, and they can get ready for 2021 and start putting together their rankings. I would say just call up, just do a Google search for depth charts, and you'll have there a bunch of different sites that will show all the NFL depth charts. And you can just go through them a position at a time, start at quarterback and go, through all the teams, start with the Baltimore Ravens. Okay. Put Lamar Jackson at number one, and make sure you're, typing these into a document where you've got it on list mode. So you can move around guys and it will let you change the numbering as you shuffle players around, but just go through all the teams with all the draftable players and sort of slot them in one at a time and see where you end up. And you can do that at all the positions and move them around throughout spring and summer and add the rookies once the draft happens, or even add the rookies now, as I've done.
Oh, you got rookies in your rankings right now?
I do. Well, at quarterback and running back right now, I'm stage where I have to insert the rookie receivers next. That's what I'm going to be working on tonight after you're in bed, Stocks.
Okay. I'm going to
6 hours behind here.
I'm going to shut you down talking about rankings now, Pat. We're going to move on to rookie running backs. No, I'm joking, obviously, but I would like to know, are you higher on Travis Etienne or Najee Harris right now without a landing spot?
Etienne. And I like Najee Harris, and I think a lot of people are going to fall in love with him because of the size. And, I'm sure by now everyone has seen that magnificent hurdle he had of that would-be tackler the other day. So I think that is going to be debated ad nauseum over the course of the offseason, which of those guys. But I've Travis Etienne would have been number two behind Jonathan Taylor for me going into this past year's draft. And I love what he does in space, and yet he can still, run between the tackles.
Yep.
Just such an exciting, I think he's just a perfect NFL prototype back, like perfect for today's NFL. I think he's going to be really good.
Last year I flip-flopped between DeAndre Swift and J.K. Dobbins as my number one running back. And then as we got closer to draft season, it went to J.K. Dobbins and Jonathan Taylor, and I never had a clear one. And I've got the same issue this year between Etienne and Najee Harris. And the more Najee Harris tape I watch, the more I like him. And I want personally to get to a point where I prefer him over Travis Etienne, but it's a very difficult thing to do when you know what Travis Etienne can do.
I totally understand the conflict.
it's really difficult. Because Murph and I wrote the book last year, and we're going to do another one this year, and I'm doing the rookie profiles. I haven't written about rookie running backs yet because I want to start with my number one running back. I did Jamar Chase as my one number one wide receiver, and then our college guys, Tom, he absolutely loves Trey Lance. So I did Trey Lance's write up as my first quarterback. So I went away from the number one consensus, but I want my running back. Kyle Pitts is locked in as the tight end one, and maybe Pat Freiermuth has some conversation about the number two, but it would be easy for me to do Pitts because he is the one, but I really want my first running back to be the guy I'm convinced is the number one. So I want to do that when I'm convinced. And I was hoping you'd say Najee Harris is another tick in his box so I could just swing a little bit further towards the Bama prospect.
You will not find any shortage of Twitter fantasy football analysts who think that, though, of stocks. So, I mean, that is going to be the civil war of the summer, I think, people having that debate all the way up to the draft, no doubt. The spring, I should say. But, yeah, and it's going to be a fun debate to have, and I think it's also going to be fun. Maybe Javonte Williams is, like, the clear number three for now. But then after that, I mean, the order of the running backs after the top three is really, you could shuffle those guys any number of ways. And I think there's going to be incredible debate over that, too. So there's going to be a lot to talk about, even in the downtime this offseason.
Yeah, we could go on, Pat, talking about rookie running backs for ages because I've got so much to say and no time to say it. But yeah, I'm fully invested in Najee Harris. And it is, again, no landing spot, isn't it? We could fall in love with these guys and they land somewhere that absolutely murders their fantasy value.
Absolutely. Yeah, we saw that with DeAndre Swift last year, didn't we?
Yep. Yeah, we sure did. Pat, this has been an absolute pleasure. I can only apologize for Murph's, which is now confirmed as a power outage. It got nuked halfway through the show. But thank you for hanging with me. Where can people find all your stuff, Pat? Where are you available?
Well, Stocks, thanks for having me. And it's always great to talk to you and Murph. And I only regret that I was not able to get in one last dig at Arsenal before Murph left us due to the power outage. But people can find the Fits on Fantasy podcast simply by Googling it and, you know, getting it on Stitcher or Apple or whatever the podcast source they prefer to use is. And they can find me on Twitter at Fits_FF. And my off season rankings will be up very soon, I think within a couple of days, at thefootballgirl.com.
It's crazy early, Pat. I'm sorry. It's crazy early. I haven't even finished getting over week 17 and your rankings for next year are already up. That is dedication to the cause. If you want, you can have another dig at Arsenal. I'm not going to stop you, and Murph will hear it when you listen. Pat, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on. Good luck. I hope Green Bay go all the way. That would be a home field advantage as well, going to that freezing north. Not good for anyone going, right?
Yes, that would be interesting if we did get another ice ball up there. But yeah, thanks again, Stocks. Always great to talk to you.
No worries, Pat. You stay safe in these troublesome times. Murph, we'll catch each other down the road. But as always, Rush Nation, don't forget, keep rushing.